welcome to A Mindful Emergence on WPVM. My name is Eddie Lesure, and I'll be joined very soon by my co-host Margaret Kirshner and our special guest for this week. We come to you live every Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. at 103.7 on your FM radio dial, or you can stream us globally at wpvmfm.org. This program is also rebroadcast Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. Our focus each week is on various aspects of recovery, discussing topics such as addiction, trauma, wellness, healing, self-care, and personal transformation, as we take an in-depth and informative look into approaches that can be integrated into daily life. All our programs are underwritten by A Mindful Emergence, a locally owned LLC that's committed to bringing integrated solutions into addiction recovery and trauma relief, utilizing body-centered mindfulness, self-compassion, and therapeutic movement practices. For more information, our website is amindfulemergence.com. And thanks to our listeners for joining us, and I want to welcome into the studio now my co-host, Margaret Kirshner. Good evening, Margaret.
Hey, really happy to be here.
Yes. And at this point, I want to welcome our guest, and I'm very pleased to be joined this week by Dr. Michael Trafford. And the theme this week is the role of applied neuroscience in addiction recovery. So welcome to WPVM, Michael.
Thank you so much, Eddie. Thank you for having me, and thank you, Margaret.
Yeah, absolutely. So the role of applied neuroscience in addiction recovery, you are a chiropractic neurologist and the founder director of innovation at Apex Brain Centers here in Asheville. And you're a clinician, a published journal author, an international speaker, a corporate consultant, and you describe yourself as a lifelong learner. Give us an idea what our focus is going to be on this week, Dr. Trafford.
Absolutely. I appreciate the intro, and it's really important. You said lifelong learner. I think that's really what it's all about, and this show is phenomenal for helping people to understand new avenues of intervention, whether it be related to recovery or anything else for that matter. So I thank you for bringing this type of information to the masses.
You're welcome.
Yeah. The title, The Role of Applied Neuroscience in Addiction Recovery, we also use the role of functional neurology in addiction recovery. It's really the understanding of the need to address brain function when dealing with conditions like addiction and addiction recovery. We're talking addiction of all types. We have the usual alcohol and substances, and then also to getting into, gambling, technology, sugar, on and on and on. Even certain behaviors obviously are addictive in nature. So understanding the underlying brain function related to addiction recovery, understanding that we're kind of working under the hood with the wiring, so to speak, and working very closely with the mental health community that's doing some amazing things with regard to trauma work and with regard to counseling and other modalities that are being implemented in the mental health arena, which also, too, are shifting towards neuroscience-based applications. We were just discussing EMDR. Obviously, that's been around for a long time, but we understand the neurological underpinnings and how these things begin to work. So it's all about bringing together those in the neurosciences and mental health. I think it's long overdue, and we need to start having these conversations.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we'll get into a lot of the different work that you do and talk about some of the science behind it. Talk about what we've learned about the brain and addiction. Your website says that your vision is to empower individuals with brain injury and adult learning and behavioral issues to build better brains and live better lives.
Yes, that's what it's about. I think most people would agree they'd rather live high quality, shorter years than low quality, longer years. So that's what it's about, is helping people live to the fullest of their potential, which is really unlimited in many cases. Once people start to realize that, once they start to rediscover hope, which in many cases has been lost, without hope, we can't get people to these places. So it is about helping people, empowering them to really you know, I tell people all the time, we love seeing you, but I hope we don't ever have to see you again.
Yeah.
You know, and I say that tongue in cheek, but that's the thing, because so many aspects of healthcare have become, including complementary and alternative medicine, have become doctor or provider dependent, meaning somebody has to come to me to get their health taken care of. And I never saw eye to eye with that type of approach. We want to empower individuals after some intensive work has been done to really take it and run on their own with some support and resources.
I've heard it said that physicians or healthcare providers should be paid based on how infrequently patients, clients need to come see them.
Right.
If they got to come on a regular basis, they should be earning less.
Right, absolutely. And there are actually some models going that direction.
Yeah.
It's interesting in emergency care.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. So how did you get interested in this? Talk about your background, your upbringing. I mean, first of all, where did you grow up? You're from the Northeast, I understand?
From the Northeast, New York, Long Island, New York.
Mm-hmm.
I don't say it like a Long Islander does, and I tend to blend in pretty well wherever I go. My New York friends tell me I have a Southern accent, but I don't hear that yet. I say y'all here and there, but
occasionally,
that's where it comes out.
Well, what were you like? What were you interested in as a kid? Were you a nerd? Were you into science and all that kind of stuff?
You know, it was one of those, and it probably made a lot of my friends angry, but was one of those that could do real well in school without, kind of like my oldest daughter, you know, do real well in school and still, you know, go to the beach sometimes more than I was in the classroom. But, you know, I did love school. I loved the sciences, always did. You know, then you go ahead and you take those tests going in towards college, and it tells you you're going to be this or you should be that. They kept telling me I should be a chemical engineer of all things. I was the kid sitting behind the TV set trying to figure out where the picture was coming from. So I had an engineer's mindset, but then when you take all those tests, you know, chemical engineer is what came up. So I dipped my toes into the water, and I really started to pile up my chemistry courses and all of that, and just realized very quickly I did not want to be sitting in a lab mixing up perfumes or medications or anything like that. You know, I think there's some great people doing that research work and doing that, but I needed to be on the front lines working with people to improve their health. So once I really started getting into the biology, embryology, anatomy, physiology, that's where things took off for me. And I explored many avenues of healthcare, many avenues of medicine, complementary and alternative medicine, and working with the person from I know the word's kind of worn out at times, but from a holistic point of view, truly looking at all systems, looking at the cognitive, the physical, the metabolic, you know, all the factors that influence one's health, were always important to me. And that's kind of where I came full circle. And once I started my studies into neurology about 20 years ago, from a postgraduate standpoint, that's where things really took off. And I really started to just become obsessed with learning as much as we could about the nervous system. And I'll tell you now, I'm the first to say, you know, I know nothing about the nervous system. You know, I thought I knew it all at one point years ago. But now, you know, the scope, the breadth, the depth, the application just widens the more you learn.
It seems like it's new stuff is constantly being discovered. Yeah.
I was going to say what you're saying too, neuroplasticity, you know, a new term that we've discovered, a buzzword.
Right.
And, you know, we're capable of changing throughout
Absolutely.
Our entire lives.
How long ago was it that there was this notion that you got a certain number of brain cells or a certain amount, a certain degree of brain capacity, and that was it? And you couldn't change and grow? I mean, it seems like when I was in high school, that's what they were teaching.
Yeah, there's, you know, the understanding, you know, obviously people just observe somebody who had a stroke in their family or a friend, and they, all of a sudden they could walk again, talk again. So I think intuitively, we've always known that the brain can change, you know, just kids learning new skills.
Mm-hmm.
But as a whole, you know, medicine established this understanding that you've got what you got, and that's it. How that's stuck for so long is beyond me, but it takes a long time to change curriculum at higher academic institutions to maintain the appropriate, you know, board certifications and degrees and all. So I think, you know, a lot of it's embedded in the, you know, the connections between the academic systems and the research systems, et cetera. But it was really the 80s when it started coming about. Dr. Michael Merzenich and others were doing some pretty incredible studies. Unfortunately, they were animal-based studies, but they revealed a lot of information showing actual changes in brain real estate, if you will, based on usage or non-usage of certain limbs and fingers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we finally understood that this is real. You can change the structure and function of your brain by doing things differently.
So to make sure that we're putting the building blocks in place in terms of the discussion that we're having this evening, define what neurology or neuroscience, what does that mean?
neurology or neuroscience, you're talking as related to addiction recovery or just in general?
Just in general.
Okay. Yeah, you know, neurology is simply the study of the brain, of the nervous system. From neuron theory, how a nerve actually conducts its information, all the way up to brain connectivity and brain networking, you know, different lobes of the brain communicating with one another. This understanding of the brain as a computer is completely false, because the brain is far from linear and, a little pocket here and a pocket there for information. If you do anything, if you think a thought, if you move a muscle, your whole brain is working, certain areas more than others. But neurology has come to the point, neuroscience has come to the point that it's so cross-disciplinary. It's not just neuroscientists anymore. It's mathematicians, physicists, biologists, psychologists, psychiatrists. Everybody has their hands in the neurology arena, because the brain controls all. And, you know, the understanding of neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to change and grow throughout life for better or for worse, is the best part of all that, because we know we can change things.
When you talk about the brain, I think most people are thinking about the brains in our heads, but is it true that we also have the brain in the belly or the gut
and the
brain of the heart, because it's so neurologically rich in those areas?
Yeah, with that, I'm sure you've probably seen or read the book, The Second Brain, by, I think it's Michael Gershon. He's a brilliant doc who talked about all of this independent neurological function of the gut, the rich amounts of neurotransmitter production. You hear about dopamine and serotonin. So there are some pretty amazing things that happen independent of our brain. Although the understanding is still that the brain is the brain in the head is the ultimate control center, coordinating everything that happens between, our organs and the brain, our muscles and the brain, et cetera, et cetera.
So were there certain events in your childhood, in your family, anything that really was significant that led you to, we understand that you liked science, but what directed you towards wanting to focus on this kind of work?
This kind of work was specific to neurology or specific to the addiction realm?
All that.
Okay. Because the neurology came first. That was really just the... I was left short in certain types of training. So when I went to chiropractic college, for example, we had the main tool of the chiropractor is the chiropractic adjustment, which is a brilliant tool, a very powerful tool if used appropriately and effectively. But I needed to understand further why this was impacting people more than just neck pain and back pain and headaches, why somebody's allergies might go away, or why somebody may all of a sudden score better on tests, or whatever the case may be, not wetting their bed anymore. Why is this? So it was this constant need to just go further and know more, to the point, where we at least were at the top of the chain, so to speak, in what was calling the shots. So, I could get to the point, whether it was a musculoskeletal problem or a learning and behavioral problem, we were able to get more consistent, efficient results. But I'd say always, throughout life, I was always interested in sports and participating in sports and human performance, that kind of thing. So just seeing how we could do things better was really what it came down to.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on the new WPVM LP in Asheville, North Carolina, 103 on your dial, and you can stream us globally at WPVMFM.org. And Margaret and I are joined in the studio this week by Dr. Michael Trafford from Apex Brain Centers, talking about the role of applied neuroscience in addiction recovery. So you alluded, Michael, earlier to the fact that neuroscience, I'm not sure how you put it, but it seems like there's been kind of a slow process within the medical world of starting to embrace neuroscience. Is that accurate? Is that kind of what you were saying?
I think more the concept of neuroplasticity. Neuroscience has always been a presence that's been very well respected, but it changes a long time to really adapt understandings to fit the educational systems that are teaching the incoming doctors and researchers and all of that. There is a kind of a disconnect or a lag when it comes to the newer understandings of the brain, and most of it's happening, kind of rogue, if you will, where you have some researchers in labs that aren't getting the funding they want, and they're finding other sources, private sources, to develop the studies they want to do to show that this brain doesn't work the way we thought it used to.
And it's not the dominant model right now in the medicalized system, right? Or is it? Is it becoming that? I mean, if you go to some of the, I don't want to mention any hospitals, I could, but right. I mean, if you go to some of the big hospitals and start talking about this with the medical staff and the director of medicine and everything, do they get this stuff or are they going, well, I don't know, this is pretty new?
I think more and more, and I don't think there would be one that would disagree that at this point in time, it's very difficult to, you know, blind a study. You know, you have these double blind placebo controlled studies. When you're dealing with the brain, there's no one variable that will impact it. The brain is sensory driven. So, you know, sight, sound, touch, taste, temperature, pressure, all these different things that stimulate the brain, not to mention cognitive processes and organic processes. There's just too much to look at to do a study on one particular thing. So I think studies are becoming more global in nature. And I think the researchers that the schools are producing now are thinking more in that direction of the multiple impacts on the brain by multiple systems, not just a single variable.
So because Margaret has to leave halfway through the show, she's teaching a yoga class later. I want to bring her into the discussion while she's still here. Particularly around the issue of the body. And it, you know, we both share the belief that it's really important to integrate, you know, the body into any type of therapeutic approach. And I was wondering if you two would sort of explore that a little bit. And Margaret, maybe you could share some of the things as a yoga therapist that you've learned and so on.
Yeah, I'm interested in how movement influences the cognitive aspects of our brain. Simple things such as crossing the arms and tapping one arm, one hand on one arm, the other hand on the other arm, and trying to hold a stressful thought, it just disappears as you tap.
Right.
How does that work?
How does that work in particular? You know, there's some complicated, as simple as it sounds, you know, doing some things, some tapping, some light muscular movements. You know, what you're doing is you're activating frontal lobe. When you move, you're activating the frontal lobes of your brain. And if you're associating that with different, you know, thoughts or, you know, inhibition of impulses, things like that, you start to create these kind of positive anchors that will hopefully lead you into more positive behaviors. There's still so much that's understood, even with seemingly simple approaches to things. But the thing is, a lot of people are looking at this. I just got back from the conference I was telling you about at Oxford University in July, and the name of the conference is called Movement. And we had folks from around the globe come together to present their papers, their observations on how movement impacts cognition. And if you just go do a Google search of movement and cognition, you will get, I can't even remember, last count was about 2.5 million references or resources that'll pop up.
Oh, is that all?
But yeah. and you know, particularly vestibular, more complicated movements, you know, we stand on two legs, which is a very difficult task. We're resisting falling all the time. But if we have a competent vestibular system to help us do that, then we have higher cognitive functions.
So vestibular system. What is that?
The inner ear mechanisms that help you control balance that are plugged in very heavily to your eyes, that are plugged in very heavily to your postural muscles. Just look at a baby, for example. A baby doesn't have higher cognitive functions because they can't resist gravity the way that a person can. And on the other end, when people start to fail physically, when they can't walk as good as they used to, when they can't balance as good as they used to, the degree of cognitive decline is proportional to the level of physical decline.
So if someone is suffering from dementia, they would have a harder time maintaining their balance physically?
Absolutely. You know, just look at folks you know that have dementia. There's probably not a single one that has good balance. Difficulty getting in and out of chairs, difficulty with gait, wide-based gait, all kinds of things that you can pick up through simple neurological observations.
So the reason, the fact that so many people in advanced age fall, is there's a connection between the fact that the brain is not functioning as well.
Absolutely.
Dimension.
Absolutely. And that's why so many retirement homes and things like that are starting to look at Tai Chi, yoga, Pilates, all these different things to keep people more sound from a postural muscle standpoint, overall strength. If they don't have good strength, they're not going to have good balance, good posture.
Right.
But, you know, kind of trailing, circling back to the vestibular system, there's a good deal of research that's been done showing the connections between the vestibular or balance system and our frontal lobes and our hippocampus, which has a lot to do with learning, and our amygdala, which is all about fear and worry. So, you know, all the balance system plugs into all parts of the brain.
Well, let's break down the brain a little bit. We're going to take a musical break in a while, but maybe we could do a basic overview. You talked about the frontal lobe. You're talking about the prefrontal cortex, mm-hmm. which is the part that has to do with language, rational thinking, and so on, and impulse control, I understand.
Yeah, and we can get even, you know, the prefrontal cortex is a big chunk of real estate. So you have your lateral prefrontal and orbital frontal and dorsolateral prefrontal. When we're talking about addiction, some of the key players are the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is your, that's the self-regulation area. That's the impulse control area to a degree. You know, these things are shared between other mm-hmm. areas and networks. But yes, that's an incredibly, incredibly important area. Orbital frontal cortex has to do with kind of registration of you know, assigning you know, reward to you know, to certain emotions and things like that. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different jobs there, but the prefrontal cortex in general is our much more human brain that is responsible and what typically goes offline in people that have longer standing addiction.
Because from what I understand is basically it's the amygdala and the limbic system that's really the primary factor in directing people's actions.
Right. The kind of desire or motivational networks that you might hear about are typically the ventral striatum, a particular area called the nucleus accumbens. Then you have also to the amygdala, and then you have the orbital frontal cortex. That's kind of the motivational core, if you will. And what happens is initially that nucleus accumbens is plugged very heavily into the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, or our self-control, our impulse control, things like that. And that's where people start using, and they may feel guilty, and then, you know, the more they use, the mm-hmm. less guilty they feel. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden there's this disconnect or this functional disconnection between our more human brain and the more primitive immediate gratification motivational network. And it's been shown, there's some really cool research we can talk about if you'd like, that is showing that these areas can be built up just as easily as they can be broken down.
And what would be a way to build them up?
Yeah, there was a great paper, and we're talking 2013, which is kind of ancient history when it comes to neuroscience research. But PLOS-1, Public Library of Science, amazing, you know, repository of information. There was a paper that came out showing a decrease in the gray matter in the prefrontal cortex of individuals using all types of substances,
right.
All types. And this was a large-scale study. And what happened was they showed that the degree of gray matter loss, and that's our, you know, the higher cognitive functions.
Right, losing that.
So the degree of loss there was proportional to the level of and the duration of drug usage or substance mm-hmm. usage or behavior usage. So the deal was they showed that within 6 months to a year of abstinence, those gray matter levels would build back up again to pre-usage levels. The catch on this one, too, is even cooler, that even longer after that, those areas got bigger than they once were before the
wow.
addiction problem, because people had to exercise so much more what they call top-down control. So their cognitive processes got incredibly dialed in when their recovery became more effective, and they simply build their brains through goal setting and you know, meditation and all these things that will help impulse control. There's, you know, a laundry list of things that can be done to build the frontal lobes, and we can go over those if you'd like.
So you may have they may have taken a step back, mm-hmm. but in a sense they've taken two steps forward. So they're further ahead than they were before they started into their active addiction,
right.
whether it was substance or behavioral,
yeah.
based on all the things that they were doing in their recovery process, activating that frontal lobe, developing it, building it?
Yes.
Sometimes there's some building back up that needs to be done because there was maybe some emotional delay when the addiction started, too. So that might be a factor.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the emotional delays and traumas are shown, too, to, you know, to cause this functional disconnection between the nucleus accumbens, that kind of, you know, the part that says, let's do this, and then the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex that says, no, we probably shouldn't do that. Yeah.
Mm.
So, you know, building that back up is the key. Getting that prefrontal cortex back online is really what it's a lot about for many, and what many of the original approaches to addiction recovery were built around, knowingly or otherwise.
At what age does that prefrontal cortex become fully developed? I've heard different numbers on this.
There's a lot of controversy there. There is, and also, too, because, you know, you'll hear things like the age at which one starts using is the age where that brain kind of of get stuck. And there's a certain level of validity to that, but it's more about the damage that's occurring to the brain or the how the brain is kind of becoming diseased as a result of usage. There's so many variables there, but it can be, you know, anywhere from the, you know, the late teens to early 20s for some.
Hmm. Yeah. And of course, you know, what Margaret was alluding to, a lot of people start heavy drug use, you know, even preteen now, mm-hmm. 10, 11, 12 years old.
Yeah.
We hear people talking about that. So the emotional part is stunted. The development of the brain is interfered with.
Right.
And, you know, here they are in their 20s. But they're really lagging developmentally.
Absolutely. And that's that thing, you know, most people would agree, if you're not having these conversations with your kid by 11 or 12, you've already missed the boat, so to speak, because that's the thing. And because we have to be their dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, because they don't have a good one. You know, they're burning on pure desire, instant gratification. I have a 13-year-old, and I know all about instant gratification every day of my life.
Sure,
You know, it's something to feed that... the desire, whether it's a new shirt, whether it's anything, you know, that has to be fed immediately. And unfortunately, they're getting access to these substances at ages when they don't have that frontal lobe.
But the good news is, even when the damage is done, for the most part, we can restore the brain functioning and even improve it beyond what it was prior to the addiction.
Absolutely. And a lot of it would depend on substance, of course, but they are showing these larger, you know, larger areas than pre-usage. But also, too, you have to think, if somebody's using alcohol for 20, 30, 40 years, they've pretty much done some significant irreparable damage to the frontal lobes of their brain, cortical atrophy, that kind of thing, shrinking. Yeah. So, you know, a lot depends on the substances used and the lifestyle they lead, because, you know, there's so much head injury and concussion in the usage arena. Mm. So there's so many factors. Again, we can't just look at one avenue, but yes.
Sure.
Well, we're going to dig into a lot of these different approaches that you use, talk more specifically about some of the other learning and behavioral disorders and so on. And but we're going to pause and say so long to Margaret so she can go and teach yoga. And thank you for joining us for the first half of the show, Margaret.
Thank you, Margaret.
Yeah, and we're going to take a musical break. I picked out a piece of music that will probably be familiar to just about all our listeners.
The lunatic is on the grass. The lunatic is on the grass, remembering games and daisy chains and laughs. Got to keep the loonies on the path. The lunatic is in the hall. Are in my hall. The paper holds their folded faces to the floor, and every day the paper boy brings more. The lunatic is in my head. You raise the blade, you make the change, you rearrange me till I'm sane. You lock the door, throw away the key. There's someone in my head, but it's not me.
And there we have, of course, from The Dark Side of the Moon, a track called Brain Damage by Pink Floyd. I think everybody knows that. And I'm joined in the studio this week by Dr. Michael Trafford, talking about the role of applied neuroscience in addiction recovery. And we're going to get back to that conversation in just a moment. This is Eddie LeSheuron from 7 to 8 p.m. every Monday on WPVM. Margaret Kirshner and I are joined by guests who come in and share their unique experience and expertise in their effort to support personal and planetary healing and wholeness. In addition to tuning in Mondays evenings from 7 to 8 and Thursdays from 9 to 10, all our programs are archived on our show host page for your convenience. So you can go back and listen to past shows by going to WPVMFM.org and going to the schedule and selecting this program. It's listed Mondays at 7. We're broadcasting Monday live, October 2nd, 2017. This is program number 91. Coming up on almost 2 years, Margaret, we've been doing this. Yeah. All our shows are made possible by A Mindful Emergence LLC, our Asheville-based company that offers classes, workshops, and one-on-one support for individuals living in recovery or wanting to experience recovery. We also offer trainings for CEU credits to healthcare professionals. You can access more information online and contact us at amindfulemergence.com. You can also find us on Facebook and LinkedIn. So just a couple of quick messages on some upcoming events in October you might want to know about. On Thursday, October 12th, the National Alliance on Mental Illness is doing one of their education pieces talking about Survive to Thrive, one person's story of lived experience with bipolar. The speaker is Chuck Fink. That's going to be at 356 Biltmore Avenue in Asheville. Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m., you can go to NAMIWNC.org to check that out. And also, the second Adverse Childhood Experiences Southeastern Summit is coming up October 19th through 21st at Renaissance Hotel in Asheville. The Art of Healing Adverse Childhood Experiences, ACEs. And you can go to mayhack.net/ACEs. 2017 and learn more about that. And of course, you can always contact me at discover@amindfulemergence.com if you need to get information about this or contact our guests. So let's return back to our guests. And speaking of websites, Michael, perhaps this would be a good time to give out your website so people can find out more about you.
Sure. It's apexbraincenters.com. So apexbraincenters.com. And also have a podcast that I backed up about 330 episodes on called trainyourbrainpodcast.com.
And you're on Facebook as well, I believe.
Oh, we're on all the outlets. You know, we love sharing cutting-edge information with people. So Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram even, you name it, Twitter.
Oh, yeah? You're way ahead of us. Well, your website, I must say, is very comprehensive. There are a lot of links, a lot of information. So if this is a topic that our listeners is interested in, it's a great resource for them.
I appreciate that.
So I'm curious, you know, at one point you really decided to focus in and turn your attention towards the addiction model. And I was wondering if you could talk about how that came to be.
Certainly. Yeah, it's, you know, it's quite a bit of an evolution of sorts since, you know, late high school and early college and getting into later college days. But what happened was you know, I spent a lot of time in the restaurant industry, and obviously the restaurant industry is rampant with issues around substance abuse. I literally started working 13 years old as a dishwasher in a restaurant and saw things that, you know, no 13-year-old should have to see with regard to folks that were dealing with severe addiction of all types. So, you know, amazing people. You know, the restaurant industry was filled with amazing people, and that's why I stuck it out, because, you know, I saw incredible value in these folks, but also too, you know, I could look past a lot of what was going on there because I saw kind of a means to an end. I had a lot of friends in there that were kind of on a track that I was on. We were going to college, different types, and grad school, and we were using it as a way to help pay through and, you know, get paid at a higher level than we would, you know, working in a pizza shop or something like that. So it was a great experience, but I started to see a lot of things and then went away to grad school, kind of fast forwarding a bit, went away to grad school, and in 1995, I had a horrible motorcycle wreck and wound up having me in the hospital for just about a month and a half. And you can imagine with tremendous soft tissue injuries and things that came about as a result of the accident, incredible infections, et cetera, that painkillers were, you know, the main source of treatment for me, aside from the antibiotics. I had that, you know, 24-hour morphine drip that they'd give you, and, you know, you feel a little pain, you hit the button, and boom, the pain is gone. Mm-hmm. So literally within a couple of days, I would say probably clinically I was addicted to morphine because, you know, it was the response. I felt a little pain, you hit the button. Mm-hmm. Felt a little pain, you hit the button. Well, things started happening. You know, I couldn't remember things anymore. People were coming to visit me, and I'd read cards from them and couldn't even believe they were in the room because, you know, my brain was telling me they hadn't been there. You know, started actually getting into somewhat of a psychosis episode. The room was closing in on me and developing phobias that I just never had. I've never had issues with phobias and fears and whatnot to that degree. So anyhow, long story short, I did get out of the hospital, and I had access to probably any type of narcotic medication I wanted. And
because of your training.
Because no, not because of the training, because the doctors.
Oh, they just whatever you need, we'll give you.
Exactly. And because of the nature of my injury and that I was going back to school and I needed to be without pain going back to school. I was told to take two semesters off. I took one. So I went back with a lot of challenges. But what I did was I said, no, I said, I'm not going to use those. And, you know, over the years, I started to look back and say, how was it so easy for me to say no to those? And we're talking, you know, Vicodin, Percocet, you name it. OxyContin wasn't a thing back then, which is obviously one of the bigger gateway drugs now, but access to pretty much whatever I wanted and didn't go that route. And you know, I started to think, did it have anything to do with my, you know, overarching goals and purpose of getting back to school and having a driving force, passion about something? And I really do agree that had some part in me not becoming addicted to the point where I couldn't give up those types of medications. So I just made a conscious choice, even though I was, you know, clinically addicted, if you will, to say, no, I'm just not going to do those and move on. And I know it's not that easy. There's a lot more to this story. But the big question remained, why do some people get addicted and why do others not, given the potentially same or similar circumstances?
And what did you learn, or what did you determine?
You know, a lot of it was that, you know, the driving force. So, you know, had I been, you know, not necessarily engaged in what I was doing, enrolled in school, you know, obviously student loans and all that played a part in it, because here I am, you know, forbearing student loans while I'm in school because I'm injured and not getting paid because I can't work and all of that. So there were so many, you know, drives to get back on the horse, so to speak, and go back to school. But I do feel there was a, you know, significant contributing factor with the passion, the motivation,
the motivation.
Purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a friend who has been working in the field of addiction for a long, long time. And he's not the only one that says this, that the number one factor that he has seen, and this has been true because I'm a person in long-term recovery, and we, and Margaret and I work in this area, seems like the number one factor determining whether someone is successful in their recovery or not is motivation.
Right, right.
How badly do they want this?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I'm not. We're not talking about willpower here. We're talking about motivation, doing what needs to be done.
Right. And that's the whole thing. You know, this, you know, addiction not being a character flaw. This is not a willpower issue. This is not a bad person. This is somebody whose brain necessarily won't allow them to develop the motivation or the wherewithal, because we have motivational networks in the brain. We have that are highly cognitively driven. And if, like we talked about before, certain parts of the frontal cortex are going offline, we can't develop those motivations. You know, you hear about these, you know, these diagnoses that exist with things like addiction, like failure to launch, and not a formal diagnosis,
right,
but, you know, a term that everybody uses. And what is that? That's low motivation, poor motivation.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to start small with folks and set reasonable, realistic, attainable goals so they can get those rushes of dopamine in a positive way to develop their prefrontal cortex. And those things begin to add up over time. And then people can build motivation. They can exercise. They can put weights in the hands of the frontal lobe and start to work it out.
Mm-hmm. Start having victories.
Absolutely.
For some of them, they haven't had any.
Yeah.
And the self-talk is very negative.
Right.
Very
right.
Uncompassionate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you probably see that. People come in thinking maybe they've been told they're a loser.
Right. And it's all about it. We're not doing the mental health side of things, and we work with a lot of great mental health practitioners that do some amazing work. We always reinforce to these folks, though, that it's really just getting more checks in the plus column than the minus column. As simple as that. We need to really just rack up those small wins, those victories, and eventually they will be big wins and victories for most.
So you work in a lot of areas. Post-traumatic stress disorder, a concussion, brain injury, strokes, ADHD, OCD, ODD. Explain what those are.
Yeah, there's, you know, it seems like a lot, but there's really two main areas, and that's the brain injured and the adulthood learning and behavioral issues.
Okay.
So the brain injured is the obvious. That would be mostly post-concussion syndrome.
Traumatic brain injury, mm-hmm. TBI.
And there's a tremendous correlation or bridge or connect between brain injury and adulthood learning and behavioral issues, because many folks develop problems with attention, focus, motivation, et cetera, and even addiction. There are such close correlations between brain injury and addiction. Both brain injuries causing addiction and addiction causing brain injuries. Mm-hmm. You know, it goes both ways. So the adulthood learning and behavioral realm, you know, there's really a solid understanding now that co-occurring or underlying most addiction scenarios are problems with attention and focus, ADHD, problems with, obsessive compulsive tendencies, looking at oppositional defiant behavior. You know, what person with addiction doesn't have defiant tendencies? That's the nature of addiction, is doing something, you know, they know and the society knows is probably not the best thing for them.
Yeah.
And then the PTSD is, you know, and getting into depression and anxiety. You know, I will be the first to say we're not really, this is important to understand. These diagnoses are really just labels or descriptions of the symptoms: attention deficit, obsessive compulsive. So we're really more concerned with the underlying neurological function of these challenges so that we can best serve that individual, so they can have more effective individual counseling, group therapies, every other aspect, you know, their meetings, et cetera, that they're going through.
So if someone comes into your office and, you know, they've identified the fact that they're dealing with a challenge and they want to get help, how would you go about approaching this? Are there certain tests that you give them? Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we look at, you know, there's different phases we work with people. We've learned over the years. I've been at this 20 years. I've been in the addictions arena probably for 8 or so of those years. And we've learned one thing, that, you know, the acute stages obviously are very difficult to work with somebody. They're concerned first and foremost on just on just getting off of the substance.
Yeah, you're not detoxing people.
No, not at all. And we've found our niche to really be in the transition realm when people are kind of going back to real life, yet they still have these challenges that they're working with. You know, they're clean and sober for a period of time that could be anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 years or longer. And, you know, we want to help these folks be able to become, you know, gainfully employed because they have better attention and focus and they're not forgetting to show up for work and all that kind of thing. By creating better brain networks, better brain functions. So the assessment, we have something we call a day of discovery where folks come into us and they spend about 5 hours with us over the course of one day. And we go through full neurological behavioral histories. We go through head-to-toe neurological examination, so looking at cranial nerves and eye movements and all kinds of cool things there, muscle reflex sensations. How is the brain experiencing that person's body? We need to do that. And then we get into the cognitive realm with cognitive batteries of tests, executive function and cognitive flexibility, attention, all these things that have to do with self-regulation, impulse control, as well as memory and things like that, the obvious. We get into tests of the physical markers, eye movements and balance. We do something called video oculography or video nystagmography, which quantifies all types of eye movements that tell us a lot about that person's brain, particularly the front brain. Balance tells us a lot about cognitive function, as we talked about before. Then there's aspects of measuring motor timing, psychological timing, and then we also look at laboratory analysis, blood sugar, thyroid function.
Metabolic functioning?
Metabolic, absolutely. Yeah.
So talk about that a little bit. I mean, what does a blood test tell you?
Well, you know, the bottom line is if somebody is not, you know, either because their addiction is causing them not to eat or not to assimilate nutrients well because their gut is not working well, they're not digesting foods appropriately. The bottom line is if there's poor gas in the tank, you know, that brain is simply not going to work as well as it should. So all the rehabilitation, all the counseling, all the treatment in the world is not going to be effective if that person is not, you know, is not packing in high quality nutrients and absorbing them and using them appropriately.
So we had a nutritionist on a few weeks ago, Medea Galligan, and she talked about the importance of healthy fats for brain functioning. I wonder if you could talk about that, because I know that you agree with that.
Absolutely. And I know Medea, and I hope she's listening to this. And, you know, we absolutely agree on these types of things. It's, you know, the brain is made of fat. It's made up of a lot of fat. There's a high volume of water, but there's a high concentration of fat within the brain. So if we're not giving back to the brain what it needs all the time, nerve conduction will suffer, the integrity of the cell walls, you know, the cell membranes, you know, every cell in your body is covered with a membrane, and these membranes are made of fat. And if you don't have the appropriate fats on board, these membranes are going to become, you know, what they call leaky, and they're not going to allow for passage of nutrients in and out of the cells appropriately. So this is why people have, you know, chronic fatigue and all kinds of problems that are consistent or concurrent with poor motivation and all of these other things.
So you'll talk to them about that and make suggestions. What are some examples of good, healthy fat sources?
Good, healthy fat sources can be, you know, we want to vary the fats. We want the essential fatty acids. So, you know, you hear about EPA and DHA or, you know, what you find in your fish oils and krill oils and, you know, flax oils and things like that. They help combat inflammation. We know inflammation is a factor in addiction now. This is coming front and center. You know, addicted brains and folks that have certain mental health challenges, they're showing markers of inflammation. There was a study that just came out looking at depression that people that took depression to suicide had very, very high levels of certain inflammatory markers within the brain. So we can look at anti-inflammatory diets, and certain fats are anti-inflammatory in nature, like those essential fatty acids.
Primarily three, isn't it? EFA,
Yeah, GLA, EPA, and DHA.
Yeah, those. Yeah. I love avocados.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Man, avocados and I started getting away from cooking with canola oils and those and using coconut oils and ghee.
Right, right. Yeah, there's so many. The key is varying. Getting them through natural sources. So looking at your, you know, nothing against some of the major store-bought brands of butter, but, you know, the bottom line is you have different ratios of fats in, you know, in grain-raised cows than you do pasture-raised cows. Yeah. So you want to look at pasture-raised butters. You want to look at virgin coconut oils. You want to look at things that are far superior from a quality standpoint.
One thing I noticed about a lot of people in early recovery in the treatment facilities and aftercare facilities facilities is they absolutely cannot seem to get enough sugar.
Right, right.
It's hitting the same receptors, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, we've had young men primarily walking into our office. And, you know, I had one guy that used to come into me, 21 years old, and he would have a backpack full of these energy drinks, you know, five or six of them that he would go through in the course
like Red
of one
Bull.
Day. Monster, Red Bull.
Yeah.
And, you know, he would go through each one of those, you know, could have upwards of 70 grams of sugar per drink, if not more, not to mention the caffeine and everything else that goes along with that.
Now, that can contribute to inflammation, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because we're, you know, just as a standard American diet, you know, approach, we're eating way too much in the way of, and it's not just sugar, but carbohydrates, a lot of empty nutrients, things that are giving us immediate fuel, but they're not high quality, densely packed nutrients like you'll find with fat. Mm-hmm. And you know, burning sugar all the time, burning glucose, which is our primary source of fuel, burning glucose all the time, you get a lot of oxidative stress. You hear of oxidative stress. That's why people are taking their antioxidants to get rid of that, and inflammation. Mm-hmm. So when we eat fat, our fuel burning becomes much cleaner. Ketones that are produced from burning fat are much cleaner sources of, or breakdown products of energy production than those that come from sugar.
What about exercise? What role does that have in helping the brain develop?
Yeah, you know, we have to move our bodies. You know, we're complex beings, and the more complex our movements, the more complex our brain, for the most part. So if people are not moving, if they're sitting on the couch all day and just moving the thumb on the remote, or not even now because you can probably just talk to the TV and tell it what to do, we're not developing brain function the way we need to.
Yeah, if you're going to watch TV, you should probably watch Jeopardy or something that at least gets the mind going.
Right, right.
I want to just jump in here for a minute, remind our listeners, this is WPBM FM 103.7 on your FM dial, and this is A Mindful Emergence. My guest this week is Dr. Michael Trayford from Apex Brain Centers. And just a quick note, if you're enjoying this program, there are a couple other shows in particular on WPBM I suggest you check out. Tuesdays from 5 to 6, check in with Laura Elliott on Wild Heart as she brings in guests from various walks of life, sharing their passions, stories, and ways of life to inspire the heart. And then Thursdays from 5 to 6, McNair Ezard hosts A Better World, where he looks at people and organizations that are working in areas such as hunger and poverty, economic and social justice, the environment, and spirituality. And they've both been doing that show now, those shows for quite a while, and just have wonderful guests. So I want to direct your attention to them. We were talking earlier when the song was playing about meditation and mindfulness practices. And, you know, Jon Kabat-Zinn developed mindfulness-based stress reduction program and through Harvard Medical Center. And as a result of that, they did MRI studies on people at the beginning and the end of these eight-week series, and they noticed that there were changes in the brain, that the prefrontal lobe had developed more gray matter, that the limbic amygdala system, the fight-or-flight part of the brain that had been hyperactive, had calmed down and reduced, and new neural pathways had developed. Neuroplasticity.
Absolutely.
How does this happen?
You know, it's this is where we talk about, you know, putting the weights in the hands of the frontal lobe. We have to work it out through different means. So certain parts of the brain, the parietal lobe, we can exercise through sensory input, so electrical stimulation and different types of things. But the frontal lobes, we have to work out through cognitive functions. And meditation is, in essence, a cognitive function because it takes a lot of mental effort to sustain focus on the present moment. It's very difficult to do. Even people that have been meditating for, you know, 30, 40 years will say it's the most difficult thing.
Oh, I've been meditating for 35 years, and sometimes I sit down and I'm crazy.
Right. I was reading something, you know, Tim Ferriss, one of these, you know, proponents of meditation and things like that. You know, he said, he'll meditate 20 minutes a day, and lucky if he gets 1 minute of pure bliss, so to speak.
But coming back, there's always the breath to come back to, isn't there? And I was wondering if you could talk about some of these breath exercises. And first of all, these are about self-regulation. So if you could define what self-regulation means and how it relates to the nervous system.
Right.
And maybe give our listeners some suggestions on some very basic practices that they can do.
Right. Well, self-regulation is a huge, you know, it's a huge buzzword, obviously, in the addictions arena. It's all about self-regulation, getting people to, you know, to be able to calm their, what we call autonomic functions. So, you know, there's heart rate and blood pressure and respiration. And obviously with certain, most types of addiction disorders, you're dealing with various levels of anxiety and, you know, where the brain simply gets out of control and that people can't control their breathing. They can't control their heart rate.
They're in fight or flight.
Exactly. So the sympathetic nervous system just, you know, gets wound up. We call it increased sympathetic tone. And the more it gets wound up, the more we cannot initiate the relaxation response.
I've heard it described as like the gas pedal is stuck on.
Yeah, absolutely. You're driving, you know, you're driving the car with the foot on the brake kind of thing. And there's all kinds of things. But yeah, and it's also very dangerous because that obviously leads to cardiovascular disease and all kinds of other things, not just the anxiety people experience. So being able to get people to self-regulate more effectively is of the utmost importance. You know, back in the day, we had a more rural practice, and I would tell people, go out the door, run down the street, and come back, and they would be a much different person after a quick sprint. We can't do that right now because we're on Hendersonville Road and a little bit more dangerous that way. So now we use things like whole body vibration. We use, you know, people can get on and increase metabolic rates and activity, therefore getting better control over their more primitive autonomic functions like breathing and all. But breathing exercises. There's something called SWAT breathing or tactical breathing, where police officers and military going into very hostile situations, they will use this. And it's very simply a breath of four in, hold the breath for 4 seconds, breath out for 4 seconds. What it does, that brief hold allows for initiation of the parasympathetic response, which will help to bring down the sympathetic response. There's a tug of war between sympathetic and parasympathetic. The more we can engage parasympathetic, the more we gain control over the sympathetic. And there's a lot of tools in the toolbox there, but that's a great, obviously, accessible, free tool. I do it every time I go, you know, on stage to talk or go into a potentially stressful situation. Mm-hmm. I do a few of those just to get my brain, my front brain back on
par. So describe that again.
Yes, tactical breathing is 4-4-4 ratio, meaning 4 seconds in, 4 second hold, 4 seconds out. Simple as that. And that will initiate the relaxation response. The key is you don't want to do too many of those. You should really only be doing 3 or 4 of those. Mm-hmm. You don't want to do 10 or 20 because you need to get more air in at a certain point. So those are just very brief, quick exercises to do if you're ramped up or if you're going into a situation you know is going to be stressful. It helps bring your front brain back online, which your front brain is ultimately responsible for, you know, basically inhibiting or slowing down the breathing and the heart rate and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've heard about resourcing, you know, imagining a situation that was very comforting is also really good for self-regulation. Like when I think about my cat, right? We have one of these love bug cats that just crawl. I mean, just thinking about holding him.
Yeah.
What does that do?
That's, you know, that could be the, you know, the dopamine, the oxytocin, but there are certain chemicals that are happening when you remember experiences like that because memories involve all parts of your brain. So visualization too, that is a very powerful technique. So when you're doing that, you're visualizing to an extent, which exercises your front brain and gets better control over your sympathetic tone.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about eye movement, desensitization, reprocessing, EMDR before. I've had experience with that. That's a very helpful way of working with past trauma in the nervous system.
Right. Yeah, we don't do EMDR per se. We have a number of practitioners we refer to. But we do a lot of eye movement reprogramming with folks based on this oculography testing I told you about.
Okay.
So we're exercising the front brain and other parts of the
brain.
So
it's a similar process. It's just not that specific model.
It's just not bringing the trauma into it. We're helping with the underlying wiring so the therapist can simply do, you know, access their clients a bit better.
Okay. I mean, there's so much we could talk about. I just looked up at the clock and realized we only got about a minute left, and I feel like there's so much to talk about. In the last minute, Michael, what is it that might be really helpful for our listeners to know about this topic?
I think the biggest thing to know is that more needs to be looked at. I think there are incredible things happening in the addiction recovery arena. I also, at the same time, believe there's a lot more that can be done, and bringing in the understandings of underlying brain function and learning and behavioral issues that co-occur with these types of scenarios needs to be looked at. So, you know, the neurosciences and the mental health sciences need to come together, get to the table, talk, and develop programs to treat more effectively.
But there's so much hope. that yes. wasn't there 40, 50 years ago. We know that we can heal a lot of these injuries, that there we can use science to our benefit to help recover from addiction.
Yes, lots of hope. You know, the flip side of that is while there's so much hope, the problems are getting worse.
And yes.
That's a topic for
Big
another
challenges
day right
out
there.
Yeah. Dr. Michael Trafford, thank you so much for coming on A Mindful Emergence.
Thank you, Ed.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in once again. We'll see you next week.